Okay, so hopefully everyone can hear me. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Tyrone McQueen. I'm actually a formal joint appointment between chemistry and physics at Johns Hopkins University. And that puts me in a rather unique position to actually try to understand how all of these beautiful theoretical models can actually exist in real life, in real materials. I used to do my acknowledgments at the end, but I realized I never get to the end of my talks. So instead, I'll put the acknowledgments up first and say that basically, you know, without this very dynamic research group that I have, as well as our Institute for Quantum Matter, basically everything I'm going to tell you about would not have been possible. So they're the ones who did the work. So here's the outline. I'm going to give one slide that's very broad, an overview, and then we're going to delve pretty much into real materials that might do this quantum spin ice thing. But I think there are some lessons from classical water ice that may not be fully appreciated here that I'd like to just point out as part of that. And then, you know, real materials, entropy always wins, which is to say when you make materials, you always end up with defects. And so the relevant question for this audience is not, are there defects? Because there always are. The question is, what are they? What's their distribution? And by changing those, can you change what ground state the system is in? So materials life cycle, you identify what you need, and in this case, the need is to instantiate a particular Hamiltonian within a real material. And I'm not going to review what those Hamiltonians are. We've seen plenty of them so far. And then you go and you try to make them, and then you see, well, did it actually do what you hoped to do? And you go back and forth. And I love this because we can discover new things. So in this whole instantiating theory, well, my students like to joke that, well, everything does actually instantiate real theory. Technically true, every object is an analog computer of itself. Well, yeah, that's true, and cheese is running a perfect simulation of itself. But that doesn't necessarily help us actually understand what's going on in these materials. This is a beautiful example of emergence, by the way, done by Reddit on April Fool's Day, where basically every person who logged into Reddit could change the color of one pixel once every 5 minutes. And you got millions of people and ended up with beautiful emergence. Okay, so spin ice. So let's start with water ice. So here's the oxygen atoms of water ice. And then there's spots sort of halfway in between each of those, and they form a diamond lattice. And if you take the spots halfway in between, then you get what we call the pyrochlore lattice. There's an old problem here, which is if you ask, well, how do I pattern H2O molecules, so two protons for every oxygen, on this structure, which is the structure observed by diffraction, there seems to be a degeneracy of states, right? So this is the residual sort of classical spin ice entropy, right? Residual entropy by Pauling. And the whole point is that basically within each of these tetrahedra, you fill two of these spots, leaving two empty, but then you have, and once you've chosen one, all the rest appear, but you have many sort of equivalent ways to do this. So there's a residual entropy here. And you all know this, and this is the origin of the idea of, well, if instead of using protons, if I instead put a spin on this that points one or two directions, then I can instantiate the spin version of this and have spin ice. What some of you may not know, though, is in fact that structure of ice I just showed you is not in fact the ground state thermodynamically stable form of ice at 0 Kelvin and 1 atmosphere of pressure. In fact, the stable form at 1 atmosphere of pressure and 0 Kelvin is this form, which is called ice 11. There's way too many forms of ice, but the point is it's picked in order. Okay, so in fact, that residual entropy that supposedly is there in water ice is not actually there in the thermodynamic ground state of ice. It goes away. This material actually becomes ferroelectric, develops a polarization along the c-axis. Okay, but okay, given that, why is it that, you know, we usually think of this material as having a residual entropy? And the reason is that we can supercool it. That essentially, it's, you know, above something like 70 Kelvin, because of entropy, because of this degeneracy of configurations, the disordered form of ice becomes thermodynamically stable. And then as you cool off through this transition, that phase transition is very sluggish. And it's very sluggish because there's an energy barrier to go from the disordered state to the ordered state. And if that barrier is much higher than the thermal energy, and it's sufficiently high to avoid quantum tunneling, then the result is you can cool this state, supercool it, all the way down to zero Kelvin, and that state then has a residual entropy. Okay? And this is not a purely hypothetical thing. So if you take ice 11, which is the ordered form of ice, and you redraw it in terms of vectors, you get something like this. And if you compare that to what has been observed in something like ytterbium titanate recently, which is observed to have a kind of ferromagnetic ground state due to the spins canting towards a particular axis, they're actually quite similar. Okay, and I'll come back to this example in just a minute. And so basically, the way I think about this as a materials chemist is if the spin value of the spin is big, then that energy barrier for spin flips is high, and as a result of that, the system behaves more or less classically. Whereas as you reduce the effective spin of this, you reduce that barrier and you allow greater quantum tunneling. So the real material that actually instantiates this behavior are based on what's called the fluorite structure. So there's a picture of fluorite that you dig out of the ground. And its structure is this. It's basically got one kind of metal cation and one kind of anion, typically oxygen or fluorine. So CaF2 is fluorine. And this structure is interesting because it has this pyrochlore lattice. In fact, it has two of them that are interpenetrating and connected. And so you get the pyrochlore from this by doing the following two things. You remove the oxygen atoms in one of the two sublattices. Okay? You then you basically pick two different metal cations for those two different sublattices. And if you do that, you get the ideal pyrochlore structure type, which has this formula. And it's a great place to look for the physics that we're interested here with quantum spin ices for two reasons. One, it's got the right structure when you put magnetic atoms on here. And two, it's incredibly structurally diverse. Okay? I'm not going to drag you through all the details. Go and read this nice review paper, which, by the way, was the first chapter of his dissertation. So I don't see many students in the audience, but think about publishing your introductions if they're good. They may turn out to be greatly valuable. The point is, you can use all kinds of different elements and the rare earths. We heard a lot about the rare earths this morning. That's the point. These tend to be great magnetic ions, and by changing the rare earth, you change the magnitude of the spin, how they interact, so on and so forth. And there's different versions thereof. And there's even defects where you can take, for example, this entire unit and replace it with a single ion. Okay? So there's lots of structural variability here. And now if you do a more complicated transformation, so you take one of the pyrochlore lattices and you transform it to its dual lattice, which is a diamond lattice of tetrahedra, of metal anion tetrahedra, and shift the oxygens a little bit, then you end up with what's called the Spinel structure. So these are all related. And why did I just walk you through all this? I walked you through all of this because this structural variability, which allows you to make a wide range of these materials with a wide range of atoms, that's the good news. But it's also the origin of many of the real materials issues. The structure type is very flexible. And because of that, you tend to be able to form large numbers of different kinds and types of defects in the structure. So the same thing that makes it ubiquitous is the thing that makes it very rich in its defect chemistry. So, defects, real quick. Thermodynamics, make sure you always have defects at high temperatures because entropy always wins. You can't avoid that by just making things at low temperature either, though, because atoms tend to just stick where you put them, and they don't move around enough to actually end up where you want them. Okay? So you're stuck either way. That's what I said. Defects always win. And in the context of these, the literature focuses a lot on what are called point defects, okay, where basically maybe you have a vacancy or you substitute one atom for another, or just put a completely different atom in its place. Those are different kinds of point defects. But in fact, that's not the only kind of defect. And in fact, in many cases, you have extended defects. And I'm going to show you some examples with respect to spin ice, where in fact, in most cases, these things don't actually have point defects. I guess that was my computer telling me I need to keep going. Okay, so here's classical spin ice, holmium titanate, and although I guess we did ytterbium here too. So the data on the left is holmium titanate, data on the right is ytterbium titanate, and you can put excess rare earth on the titanium site, and these are called stuffed spin ices. And I mentioned you derive the pyrochlore as an ordered version of fluorite, and that's indicated by the so-called pyrochlore-only reflections, like this one in the diffraction data. And as you put ytterbium on the titanium site, that superlattice reflection decreases in magnitude. So this is normally interpreted in the literature as you replace titanium with holmium or with ytterbium, you destroy the pyrochlore ordering. Okay? But that's actually not the case. So here's electron diffraction data. And I just want you to focus on it's a mess. which is to say, not only do you have the spots that you would expect from the fluorite, which are these nice circular ones, but you actually have all of the spots that you'd expect from a pyrochlore, which are all these sort of lozenge-shaped ones, this one and this one. So even though the material by diffraction looks like a fluorite, which is to say you've disordered everything, in fact, on a local scale, it remains ordered. And not only does it remain ordered, there's then some crazy supercell here. This is what you get for having great collaborators. Henny Zandbergen noticed this, that you get this whole set of like this sevenfold supercell in this crazy direction in the structure. All of this is saying you might naively think of putting ytterbium on the titanium site as being a point defect. You just sort of every so often you've randomly replaced the titanium with the ytterbium. Okay? That's not the case. Locally, it picks up orders, and these orders get to be very complicated. So what's the impact on the physics? Well, here's from volume 2 of Nature Physics. This was back when Nature Physics was young. If you do this in the case of holmium titanate, which is sort of a canonical classical spin ice, basically, this residual entropy, which again, remember, this is presumably some kind of supercooled state and not truly the intrinsic thermodynamic ground state, but the residual entropy there seems to be about right and independent of this local doping. And this is essentially the thermodynamic manifestation of the fact that locally the structure's not doing much. It's still a pyrochlore. Okay. So now what about for quantum spin ices, so things with larger effective spins? Smaller effective spins. So let's take ytterbium titanate as an example. Here's low temperature specific heat versus, and those the log scale here, versus temperature for ytterbium titanate. Only now, instead of putting, 30% ytterbium on the titanium site, we're changing the composition by 1%. Huge changes in the specific heat in this temperature range, right? Seemingly small changes have a huge impact on the low temperature specific heat, okay? And by the way, this one, which has this gigantic peak in the heat capacity at low temperatures, can make you think that your dilution refrigerator isn't working. Because you cool off, you cool off, you cool off, you hit this temperature, and the temperature doesn't go down. And you wait 10 minutes, and the temperature still hasn't gone down. And you wait, and the temperature still hasn't gone down, right? But really, that's just the time it takes to extract all of that heat from the sample before you're then able to cool off. Okay, so small changes in composition have apparently large impact on what the specific heat looks like at low temperatures. But it actually, and so the question was, given that extreme sensitivity to small variations in composition, can we find a way to control that chemically? And the answer is, due to Syed and Kate, yes, they were very clever. So Syed looked at the ytterbium titanate phase diagram and said, well, here's the compound we want, YB2-Ti2O7, and you can just melt it and try to make it. But you can lower the melting point, which has the effect of reducing the number of thermodynamically driven defects in the material, right? Because so negative T delta S, as T goes down, the equilibrium number of defects from thermodynamics goes down. And you can do that by using excess TiO2 as a flux and grow, you know, so you pick a composition like here and you can grow out of that, okay? And when you do that, you get crystals that look like this. And this made me very happy because most pictures of most crystals of this material in the literature are colored. And that's a problem because if ytterbium is really on the A side of this material, the energy levels of the ytterbium ion are such that it shouldn't have a color. So there shouldn't be any absorptions in the visible region of the spectrum, okay? So the fact that it is colored in most samples is a direct manifestation of the fact that you must have some ytterbium on the titanium site. And essentially, by going to titanium excess flux and lowering the temperature, one can get rid of those, okay? And when one does that, by the way, one gets this giant peak in the specific heat. Despite these huge changes in the specific heat, which are very dramatic, if you actually integrate it, so if you actually integrate C over T and get the entropy and ask, is there really a large change in what's going on with the entropy here? The answer is not so much. So the crystal one is in red, you get the R log 2, this is the pseudospin of a half. And the point is that as you disorder it, as you add these other kinds of defects, you tend to smear the entropy out, but it doesn't seem to change the total amount of entropy that's there and lost and then recovered, okay? So this doesn't necessarily mean that there's any change in ground state here, okay? This is just a change in how you are actually ending up in the ground state, okay? All right. And I should point out that recently-ish, on classical spin, it's a couple of years old now, somehow the citation got lost. On classical spin ice, so this is dysprosium titanate, something kind of, going back to this, they're actually super cooled. So here's sort of the original sort of spin ice data here in green. And if you really let the sample equilibrate, then you start to see that you're gonna lose a lot more entropy, even in dysprosium titanate. So I think that's an important lesson. Now that doesn't make these states any less interesting. If they're not the thermodynamically stable ground state, but you can still trap them at zero Kelvin, that's still exciting and interesting, at least to me. And so the difference here, the point is that this energy barrier, right, seems to become very important. If that energy barrier is big, then one can really trap these disordered states at low temperature. Whereas if that energy barrier is smaller, you tend to pick an ordered state. And so in the context of quantum spin ices, I find this very interesting, where it's actually much harder to supercool ytterbium titanate than something like holmium titanate. The same thing that's gonna make it more quantum-like is the thing that actually helps it get to its ordered ground state. That's an interesting thought. This is not unique to ytterbium titanate. So here's another one that's another quantum spin ice, praseodymium zirconate. And I'm not going to run you through the details of all the data here. I just want to show that, in fact, there are huge changes in the specific heat as a function of small changes in composition. Okay? And again, some nice work by Syed and Ben sort of went through a lot of the gory details. Now, what's the impact of this on the actual physics? Well, it's actually cool. You can actually make a spin liquid by doing this. These small changes in composition, which have some effect on local scale disorder, actually can let you make a spin liquid. So I don't actually have the data because I don't know that it's published yet, but Colin will probably not shoot me if I say that you can take this material in small changes in composition. You can basically take most of the scattering from the elastic channel and put it into the inelastic channel. So these little changes in composition, you can actually move most of the magnetic scattering around and switch it between elastic and inelastic, or ordered and disordered. Okay. Here's a little bit more specifics about this. So this is inelastic neutron scattering. And what do I want to show you? Well, up here I want to show you that here's the elastic line, and then here's energy transfer. And they're seen at zero applied field. There's some continuum of magnetic excitations, which is suggestive of a gapless state. And as you apply a field, you can actually gap out this state. But there's something funny that happens here, which is to say, normally, if you were to do this, this spectral weight would shift to the right, and you'd see increases in the scattering at higher energy transfer. Does that make sense? Because basically, you make a split, you now have more states from which you can do an excitation, and so this scattering should move to the inelastic channel. But that actually doesn't happen. This high energy transfer side seems to stay more or less the same. So where's all that scattering going? And the answer is it's all going into the elastic channel. So actually, by applying the magnetic field here, you're inducing some kind of order in this system. Okay. And I just want to emphasize that these small changes in composition, it seems a little wild that 1% changes in composition can move around 90% of the magnetic scattering in a material, okay? But in fact, so this is zirconium nuclear quadrupole resonance, so think of it like an NMR experiment, on three different samples of praseodymium zirconate that vary very slightly in composition. And the beauty of NQR, or NMR techniques in general, is that they're very sensitive to sort of the intensity here is proportional to the number of. So you tend to be sensitive to what's going on to the bulk of the material, not what's happening at just a few defect sites. And what you see is that these small changes in composition are radically changing the resonant frequency, and hence what the local chemical environment looks like for a majority of the zirconium atoms here, and by implication, the majority of the praseodymium, the magnetic praseodymium. So that's another complicated thing, but it's an important statement that the small changes in composition are in fact affecting the local chemical environment of most of the atoms in the material. And we'll get to how that happens, we think, in a minute. But this is good news in this case, because this distribution of fields appears to allow you to stabilize this gapless state in praseodymium zirconate. And this doesn't seem to be unique to this material. Again, see work by others on things like terbium tightening. Okay. Now, everything we've just done so far has been about magnetism on the A site. And that's because for rare earth pyrochlores, that's where all the magnetic action is. But there's been some interest in B-site magnetic materials, and I'm thinking of Y2MO207, so yttrium molybdate, which would be spin 1 on a pyrochlore lattice. But in fact, there's a lot of older work going back more than a decade on actually niobium on the B-site. So the niobium oxidation state is 4+, so this would naively be spin 1/2. So this is naively niobium 4+, spin 1/2, on a pyrochlore lattice, okay, directly, which is very interesting. Except for it turns out it's not actually magnetic, okay? I'm summarizing a lot of work. Turns out, at least in the niobate, there's no actual magnetism there. You may think there is, but it actually all comes from defects and other things. There's no magnetism there. What happens is the niobiums don't stay in their ideal spots on the tetrahedra. They tend to distort inwards and form metal-metal bonds. So you take the unpaired spins on adjacent niobiums, and they come together and form a bond and actually displace the niobiums into the material. And there's some nice theory work by Peter Blaha that basically predicted that this should happen. Okay? But this does not show up in the long-range ordered crystallography. And it doesn't for the same reason that you don't easily see a long-range ordered spin ice stain. Or just like ice 11, although it's thermodynamically stable, is not the one you usually see. And it's because you can actually, there's an entropy to be gained by disordering that on a local scale. And so the only reason you know this is there is when you do electron diffraction and you see not only the pyrochoral reflections, but all of this other stuff, all this other scattering, this diffuse scattering, which is indicative of this local off-centering. And I'm not going to walk you through how, but go read the papers if you want to know. Okay? So here's what I've just told you. Ice and spin ices have states with finite ground state, are observed to have states with finite ground state supergeometry, but in most cases, this is probably some kind of kinetically trapped state. Okay? It's because it would be a first-order phase transition to the ordered state. Thus, there's some energy barrier that one has to get over to form the ordered state. And if quantum fluctuations are weak enough that you don't tunnel through that barrier, and thermal fluctuations are weak enough that you don't go over that barrier, then you can actually trap yourself in this degenerate set of states. Okay? And disorder can seem to help drive a system to a spin liquid state, or at least something with some dynamics. And there's lots of evidence that the local structure, you know, we have this idea of what this ideal structure looks like, and that's almost always wrong. The global structure is almost never reflective of what seems to be going on locally, and that seems to have a big impact on the physics as observed through the composition dependence. Now, do I have to actually walk you through every single one of these materials because they're all different? And they all do different things? Or is there something sort of more universal going on here? And I guess by posing that question, I'm telling you it's going to be universal, although I'm going to show you the data for one material to make the case for that. So here is, again, this NQR, this nuclear quadrupole resonance data for basically on stoichiometry, 1% zirconium-rich, 1% zirconium-poor. And what you see is that basically here the resonance is very sharp. What does that mean? That means all zirconium sites are essentially equivalent. Here, there's a broader distribution of what the zirconium local site symmetry looks like. And here, it's really broad. You know, this is not just 1% zirconium on the praseodymium site. That would show up as sort of two distinct peaks. This is, by changing the composition that tiny bit, there's now a huge change in most of the local site symmetries. Okay. Why? Well, can we actually observe that? And if you have friends who are the world's experts in electron microscopy, the answer is yes, yes, you can. So this is high resolution STEM HADIF. So this is high angular dark field imaging. So basically, you see where the atoms actually are, okay? And you're doing this in a scanning sort of probe microscopy. And you can even do point by point, you can do chemical analysis, which is what's indicated by the colors here. So basically, red is either praseodymium or zirconium, and blue is the other one. And then purple are columns of atoms that are mixed of the two. And so first of all, we can actually look for things like these point defects that I mentioned maybe exist. And this material is nominally perfect stoichiometry, two praseodymiums, two zirconiums. We shouldn't see any sort of site mixing or point defects. And indeed, we don't. Okay? To the limits of what we can do with electron microscopy, we don't see any of that. Which is to say, if there are any of those kinds of defects, they're very low. They're very small. But if you look at this pattern in detail, what you actually see is that the atoms, these columns of atoms, are displacing in interesting ways from their ideal positions. Now, one has to be very careful in this analysis because there's lots of experimental artifacts that can be origins of this, so one has to be incredibly careful in doing this experiment. But when you do it right, what you find is that basically across every sort of row, basically you look at the distances between columns. And on every even row, or let's call it odd row, since it's row one, labeled row one, every odd row, all those distances cluster around a single number. And on every even row, they cluster around two numbers. Why is that important? That's important because if this is an ideal pyrochlore, these rows should be indistinguishable. They both should cluster around single numbers. So this is direct observing where the atoms are evidence that even in a nominally perfect pyrochlore, okay, the structure is locally and on a time scale of this measurement, which is to say 10 minutes, not that ideal structure. So this isn't just a phonon. This is actually some sort of built-in quenched structural disorder, even though chemically it's very good. And it turns out this is a really hard experiment, and there's maybe two places in the world you can do it. So what you like to do is find a way to make it easier so you can know that it's in lots of different materials. And so we switched to electron diffraction to answer that. And all I want you to see is that in addition to nice spots, you now see all these other streaks and things, and those are characteristic of this effect. Okay? I'm not going to walk you through how. You can read our paper. I'm happy to provide it to you to learn how. And we see it in every single pyrochlore that has ever been looked at by us or by others has this effect. Ytterbium titanate, lanthanum zirconate, bismuth titanate, bismuth ruthenate. Basically, anything that's been stuck in an electron microscope has this. So there's something universal here. Whatever's causing this distortion from the ideal pyrochlore structure appears to be universal in this family of materials. Okay, so what is it? Well, here's what it is. And there's a huge amount of work I'm not showing you that we got it. So it's the same thing that goes on in quartz, essentially. So beta cristallite is one form of quartz, and it has the following thing. So the quartz SiO2 is the same thing as the AO prime network in the pyrochlore lattice. So you have PR2O is this blue with the oxygens in between. And beta cristallite is well known to have this structural flexibility. That basically you can have a cooperative rotation of all of these SiO2 tetrahedra, which flexes the structure. In the pyrochlore structure, you've got the same thing with praseodymium and oxygen here. So there's this structural flexibility. Okay? And in some materials, like praseodymium zirconate that I showed you, this structural flexibility is actually frozen out in some kind of quenched disorder. You know, the whole material isn't picking one direction in which to order for this. But locally, on domains typically, by the way, I think around 40 angstroms in size, it has picked sort of a local displacive motion here. Okay? And this explains why it's very composition sensitive, because this is a cooperative motion of this PR2O framework. So if I break up that framework a little bit, if I replace a praseodymium every so often with a zirconium, then those act as pinning centers for this displacive motion, right? Or break it up, and vice versa. If I replace one of these zirconiums here with a praseodymium, that acts as locally a little bit bigger, and thus changes the local flexibility of this framework. So this is how a small composition dependence can affect the bulk intrinsic properties of the material, is that there is this underlying, sometimes it's soft phonon, sometimes it's actual frozen out local structural disorder. But this structural flexibility is then why small composition changes can have a huge impact on what goes on with the structure. And how does that impact the physics? Well, because guess what? You know, here you are in the pyrochlore, and as we saw in the earlier talks, you're using some combination of point symmetries, as well as things like time reversal, to constrain what can happen to the moments on the rare earth ion. Well, here's what happens when you undergo this distortion. You go from this table on the left, so D3D. That's the point symmetry of the A site in a pyrochlore, okay? And it's D3D, which means it's got these C3 operators and C2, so threefold rotations, twofold rotations, inversions. This is the double group, so you have to deal with going around 720 to be really identity. and you know, you've got improper things and all this. The point is that you get all of these sort of singly and multiply degenerate states for both the even number of electrons and odd number of electrons case. Okay? Which is to say there's some actual point symmetry that constrains what the low energy set of states in these materials has to look like. And you go from that to nothing other than identity in time reversal, and that's the point, right? So this structural flexibility basically breaks all of the point symmetries locally around these magnetic ions. And so then it should come as no surprise that that has sort of a big impact on how the material behaves. Okay? And I didn't directly show you, but actually the energy scales of these are actually very similar to magnetic interactions or crystalline electric fields. So you can actually see this in the specific heat, and in many of these pyrochlores, there's an Einstein mode in the specific heat that peaks somewhere between 10 and 20 Kelvin. That corresponds to a local phonon, which is actually this displacive motion that I just showed you. Okay? At an energy of something like a half to 1 millielectron volt, right? Which is in the right energy scale to be competing with all these other things that we're, with all the other energy scales that are going on in these materials. And so one could take that as a very negative message. Oh dear, well now we gotta consider all the phonons and everything else too. This is gonna be a mess. But actually, I think the praseodymium zirconate story tells you that actually this can be a very powerful thing. That in fact, actually the presence of this local structural flexibility can actually help you select some of the more interesting states, ground magnetic states in these materials. Okay. So in the 5 minutes or whatever I have left, I was asked to talk a little bit about other versions, sort of where the frontier of this is in terms of materials. So here's work by Bob with IQM. So you can take the pyrochlore lattice, and if you get rid of 1/4 of the ions, you can make a Kagame lattice. And this has been done for a variety of materials now. This is all published. And all I want to point out is here's magnetization data, here's specific heat again. There doesn't seem to be huge differences between the low temperature physics of these materials when you do this. And actually, that's not so surprising. So if you actually look at the magnetic order of this structure, for example, it actually is not so different from what water ice would have predicted. Okay, for the Kagame layers. So that's one thing you can do. Here's the other thing you can do, is you can say, well, rare earths are great, but as we noted, super exchange typically is very weak with the rare earths because it involves overlap of localized F orbitals with anion P orbitals, okay? Well, if you can make these out of transition metals instead, you can in principle make the super exchange a lot larger, and here's how you do that. You have a graduate student Jason, who's crazy enough to work with HF gas, hydrogen fluoride gas, which is kind of toxic and corrosive and all kinds of nasty things. But when you do it right, you can make these beautiful giant crystals of these pyrochlores, where you have, and you have to go to fluorine to make the charge balance work. Manganese 2+, iron 2+, and these two, or cobalt 2+ over here. And the point is that now you have transition metals on a pyrochlore lattice. So your exchange interactions can be a lot bigger. Here are, for example, Curie-Weiss thetas, which are generically indicative of this, negative 100 Kelvin, right, instead of a couple Kelvin, which is what you see in normal spin ices, based on rare earths. So you can make the super exchange be very important here. And because you can produce them as these nice crystals, you can start to really understand what goes on with the dynamics. So that's another frontier. I want to point out there's a connection between spin liquids and some of the things that's being thought about in terms of J effective of a half states, for example, in these derivatives of the spinel structure. But again, this goes back to the fact that the niobiums don't stay in their ideal position. They distort to make these little cluster units. And if you get the electron count right, those units can behave as spin a half if you get the electron count right. And then you can build up lattices from that and do all sorts of interesting things. And since I am really out of time, I just wanted to emphasize one other thing, which is we're really in the process of setting up a beautiful sort of expanded set of materials creation capabilities at Hopkins. So the video on the top left is a crystal growth at 300 atmospheres of applied gas pressure. It's the first time that's ever been done in the world. This video on the right is what's called a laser pedestal growth. It's a way to grow single crystals of materials that otherwise tend to be very volatile. And we're combining that with sort of big data learning techniques to actually model what's going on in the molten zones of these sort of crystal growths in real time. So I've said enough. And I'm happy to take questions, but hopefully, you know, my message has been clear enough to emphasize that real materials are on the one hand messy, but on the other hand, that messiness can actually be very rich and give rise to very rich behavior. So thank you. Yeah, okay, right. So, great, strain. Yes, absolutely. And so praseodymium zirconate in particular is very complicated because when one grows crystals of praseodymium zirconate, one has to worry a great deal about mixing in a molten zone. And if one does not sufficiently mix one's molten zone, one can actually get compositional variations which do not show up when you look at the crystal itself. So in fact, it can look like the most beautiful crystals of praseodymium zirconate actually have, on the scale of a micron, compositional phase segregation. So that is one thing I didn't mention that is absolutely a consideration. But this, all of that is really a manifestation of this more general point. We typically think about it in terms of, you know, small compositional changes and point defects, but in fact, that's not what then really happens in the real materials.
Bruce Nedvig. So the sample variability, you know, certainly in terbium titanate, people only realized this when they started to grow single crystals. That polycrystalline material, for the most part, is pretty. You get pretty much the same results no matter what.
Not if you change the composition by a little bit.
No, right.
If you're aiming
to grow stoichiometric material, it doesn't matter who grows it; they get a big.
Correct, and so that's actually a good example of the following fact. It's easier to control stoichiometry in powders than in single crystals, and the reason for that is in crystal growths, you're limited by essentially the phase boundary edges. The composition you end up with is whatever composition is at the interface of the liquid with the solid. And so what this means is that one typically grows with maximal number of defects or off stoichiometry, typically. Whereas with powder, since one is never actually going to the melting point, one can actually obtain anything in the single phase region. And so you actually have substantially better control over the stoichiometry using powder-based methods that don't involve melting. And this is something we routinely take advantage of, this fact. And so you're absolutely right. If you pick one composition, you routinely get the same physics. And we take that as an important sign that, in fact, those are all real behaviors of that particular composition.
So I think that titanium titanate is usually considered as one of the rare earth particles with the strongest magnetoelastic coupling.
Yeah.
Do you have an idea or comment about the lattice deformation or coupling? Is it particularly enhanced or different in this material compared to other particles?
I don't have hard data to show you right now, but based on things that I have seen, I don't think it's particularly different there compared to any of the others.
You might go to somebody else if you want. You see.
Is there any already direct evidence for this low energy photon dynamics in strongly off-stoichiometric praseodymium zirconate samples?
In every single one we have ever looked at, and you can see it in the specific heat if you look for an Einstein mode in the specific heat.
Almost the same question. So it should be observable in neutrons. Right.
Right. And so then it's just a question of so of course you're now at very low energies, right? So you're now looking for this very low energy phonon, and the the scattering there, as you know, is more, you know, goes as Q squared or whatever, right? And so you really need access to that higher Q region to really know that it's there, especially if it's a diffuse sort of more localized thing. But I would say that if you, so we haven't looked at many of the data sets so far, but of the data sets we have looked at, certainly one can say there is such a thing there. And it, but I take specific heat as conclusive on this point. I mean, the specific heat says it's there, so it's there.
I mean, the soft photon, transitions in ferroelectrics and such, you know, those are really well studied in the 70s.
And so I should point out that this distortion in the pyrochlore, it's actually a ferroelectric distortion, but it's frustrated by this pyrochlore connectivity, which explains why all these bismuth compounds, for example, which should be ferroelectric, are not.
This frozen in rocking distortion, is there, do you have like an estimate for the average displacement of the anomalous?
Yeah, I guess I didn't mention that, but so in the case of prison, so the answer is yes, and it varies, as you saw, quite substantially with composition, even within a given material, let alone between materials. That said, in the case of praseodymium zirconate, Colin can correct me if I'm wrong, but it was like 0.01 angstroms or something, right?
From the 0.02.
0.02 angstroms, right. So so you can get this from the distribution of crystalline, from basically, so praseodymium 3 plus is non-Cramer's doublet. So when you move it off the ideal site symmetry, you're allowed to split the ground state into a singlet, and you can actually measure the distribution of those splittings due to the frozen in structural disorder. And that, from that, within a point charge model, you can then estimate sort of rigorously how small this distortion is. And in this case, it's about 0.02 angstroms.
But there's not a direct measurement of that.
Well, So we have it from the structural data as well, but it turns out that's a small enough structural change that that's actually really hard to observe.
Okay.
But it is there.
Okay, maybe you can try to wrap up in like a couple of minutes, so quickly, please, Elena.
So if your compositional dependence on the low temperature specific heat of a terbium titanate, so a lot of the entropy release actually happens at much higher temperature. And did you look at that?
So there's two portions of energy loss in ytterbium titanate. And the higher temperature part is sort of the classic entering a spin ice type state, right? So that's why we plotted it in that kind of funny way. That basically from, here, basically this part of the entropy loss, this is sort of the entropy loss you'd expect to go from paramagnetic to normal spin ice.
And so there's no compositional dependence on that?
Not a substantial one. And that, if you think about this in analogy to water ice, this isn't surprising, because it's really only when you then go away from that low energy spin ice manifold of states that this structural flexibility starts to become important.
Exactly, just this transparent. If you see this transition, basically, your single crystal has a higher transition than that of your stoichiometric powder samples.
This is not the best stoichiometric powder sample. If you make the world's best stoichiometric powder sample, it looks basically like this crystal. Now, that said, if I may just potentially project the question and give you an answer, because I meant to say this and I didn't, this is the sharpest transition, which means you've got a clean first-order phase transition. That doesn't actually mean it's the perfect stoichiometry, right? That just means that the material is such that that is the point where you can cleanly enter this ordered state. And so these crystals, right, that I've shown you that are very clear, they have no ytterbium on the B site. That's the good news. The bad news is, simple thermodynamics and the temperature of the growth being 1900 C tells you should have something around 0.25% titanium on the A site ytterbium framework, which is to say, going back to this low energy. So there's a distinction there. You know, which of these is really the ideal stoichiometry? Actually, I don't know. But what I know is that as you change how that low energy flexing motion works, the ability to undergo this first order phase transition changes drastically.
Only in this direction, if we assume this stoichiometry can be used to drive the system into quantum spin equilibrium state, then we can use also this stoichiometry to drive the system into a Langevin water state. So that's actually wonderful too.
Yeah, I think you're right. No, I think that's correct. I mean, I think that's right. And the mechanism of that appears to be the small changes in composition affect this low energy flexional motion, which is how a small change has a big effect.
For example, the work by Kadowaki on terbium titanate, the one sample that had the largest specific heat anomaly are those which are of the stoichiometric target.
Yeah. So, I mean, I should just mention as a chemically right here, these are all really small changes in stoichiometry, and so systematic errors in one's chemical analysis technique become extremely important, right? I am actually unaware of any reliable chemical analysis technique that will give you, on an absolute accuracy, sub-percent ratios of elements. You can get relative accuracies that are way higher than that, but in terms of absolute accuracy, which is you know precisely what the composition is, there actually is not such a tool. Okay? That's an important point. And so the way you get these stoichiometries right is you take advantage of the fact that in powders, you have better control over the precise stoichiometry, and you can put limits. If you know what you put in, you can then put limits on how much it changes based on mass losses and things, and that then lets you in an absolute way bound the composition.
Okay, I see. Well, I'm just going to comment on your talk about the Kadowaki. It was exactly this point that the phase with a large heat capacity anomaly, actually the heat capacity anomaly goes away as you go along composition to either side.
Right.
And so I would guess it's probably the case that it is actually maximized on stoichiometry, but it's very hard to measure on stoichiometry.
But I did say it's off the target.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, here it goes away, right, either way. Minus 0.01 and 0.01 both destroy it, right? And
okay.
I'll leave it there.
Okay, thank you.